but not limited to mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country.
Today on Rainbow Country, Queering Marvel, Queering DC, with award-winning comic artist and writer Phil Jimenez. That and more in episode 446, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbecue.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hello and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country, as I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto, and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, a flashback to my 2021 interview with award-winning comic artist and writer Phil Jimenez, who joins me to talk about his involvement in Wonder Woman 1984. We also get his thoughts on the popularity of comic book movies and so much more. Plus in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some classic house, a gay men's set, and more. All that lies ahead as we start journey 446 through Rainbow Country, and our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning New York Times bestselling author Julie Lithcott-Haynes gives us the history of the modern-day term, adulting.
It was the millennial generation that turned adult from a noun into a verb. They were the first to say, I don't want to adult. I don't know how to adult. Adulting is scary. And it raised a lot of eyebrows. Like, what are they doing? Why are they saying that? And again, I wasn't judging them. I was curious. Why have they decided it's such a thing that they have to speak about it in this active verb-like sense? They felt like they couldn't do it. And they would say things like, I don't know how to adult, i.e. I don't know how to file my taxes. I don't know how to change a tire. I don't know how to iron a shirt. And I think, you know, that's a function of, well, maybe my parents didn't teach me. Maybe my academic upbringing was so much about intellectual enrichment or pressure or perfectionism that nobody bothered to teach me how to sew a button, or, you know, they canceled shop class and home ec because it was all about the most advanced academic classes. There is that component that young people are arriving at age 18, age 21, not knowing how to do the tasks of life that in prior generations, you just sort of learned along the way because everything wasn't so busy and stressful. But in my book, I say that knowing how to iron the shirt or sew the button or pay the bill is really the easy stuff you can learn by watching a YouTube video. The harder space is inhabiting the mindset of wanting to adult. And of course, having to adult, meaning there isn't, you're not so privileged that there are a set of people making your decisions for you. Wanting to adult is saying, yeah, it's work, it's responsibility, but I want the delicious feeling of knowing I'm in charge of my life. Too many young adults are still under the thumb of well-meaning parents who are trying to handle every little thing. We parents think it's helpful. It's actually undermining agency and resilience and really makes a young person feel like, am I an adult? I'm not sure I am because I have to check in with my parents on everything.
'69 was a big year. It was the year that saw both the Stonewall riots in New York and more or less decriminalization of gay sex in Canada. The following year, the Americans celebrated the anniversary of Stonewall with Christopher Street Liberation Day. That was the summer of 1970. They didn't actually call it Pride at the time. August 1st, 71 was Toronto's first official gay picnic at Hanlon's Point. It was organized by the Community Homophile Association of Toronto and Toronto Gay Action. 300 people showed up. Now, that wasn't officially a pride, but Gerald Moldenhauer, one of the veterans of those days, maintains that a march down Yonge Street a few weeks later should be called the first Toronto Pride. That was a warm-up for the more famous We Demand demonstration in Ottawa held August 28th that year, a protest against the inadequacies of Trudeau's decriminalization. By the way, if you want to see some pictures of those early days, check out Gerald's website. It's geraldmoldenhauer.com, and it's spelled J-E-A-R-L-D-M-O-L-D-E-N-H-A-U-E-R. The first official Toronto Pride was actually the next year, 1972, again in August. Then there was a second Gay Pride Week, August 17th to 26th, 1973. That one was national, not just Toronto. There were events and marches in Vancouver, Saskatoon, Ottawa, Montreal, and Halifax. The focus was political, on ending discrimination against queers, something that was still quite legal across the country at the time. Then, the following year, 1974, there was Pride number 3 in Toronto, August 17th. I came out of that one, so I remember it very, very well. We marched over to Queen's Park to again demand human rights protection. And then they stopped. There was nothing in 75. People were focused on a national lesbian and gay conference in Ottawa. And again in 76, all of us in Toronto were busily preparing to host the fourth national lesbian and gay conference, which happened in September. Gay Days was a big festival in 78, but nothing called itself Pride again until 1981 after the Bath Raids. That's where the misconception that Pride began after the Bath Raids comes from. 81, I suppose, is significant because that's when the shift happened from August to the last weekend in June to harmonize with Prides across the U.S. But that's not the first Pride. So when you hear someone say that the first Toronto Pride was in 1981, you should politely point out that that's not quite true. Toronto and other cities in Canada had our own August Prides for almost a decade before that. And there are still those of us around who remember. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, award-winning comic artist, Phil Jimenez.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Jimenez, hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you? I'm well.
Am I saying your name correctly, Phil Jimenez?
You are, which is very exciting.
It's the little things in life, isn't it?
It is. A lot of people still say it Jimenez, which...
Jiminy Crickets.
Jiminy Crickets. It continues to surprise me. I don't know why. Especially in areas with large, like, Latino populations, it's such a common last name, although I know sometimes it's spelled with G, but I'm rambling on. But it's always nice when somebody gets it on the first time.
Well, I always say this to my guests, but thank you for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. Thank you for that. You and I first met in 2019 in Toronto at the Fan Expo. That was my very first one.
My first
Fan Expo, Comic-Con, that sort of thing. How many of those Fan Expos, Comic-Con have you done over the course of your career?
Do you mean around the world or in...
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. So there was a point where I was doing, I would say, between 6 and 10 a year.
Wow.
So I would say with smaller comic shops, larger conventions, I probably have done 1,000 or more.
Wow.
Over a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine 6 to 10 every year. For the past 30 years. Is that right? So it's 300, 3,000. Regardless, clearly I can't do math, but also...
A fair amount.
It's a fair amount. I started doing conventions as a fan back in the 1980s as well. So they've been a part of my life for, oh my gosh, going on 35 years.
So Felimanas, you are a visual artist. You're mm-hmm. a comics artist, a writer, a storyteller, an educator. You've worked for DC Entertainment, Marvel Entertainment, two huge companies when it comes to comic books, when it comes to superhero movies. Let's start here with you. Superhero movies, Wonder Woman 1984. You are in the credits of that movie.
I got a special thank you, and I was actually very pleased. I got a special thank you in the first movie as well, and had the opportunity to go to the premiere there. And one of the things that was actually really wonderful about that year was that I was also invited to the United Nations on Wonder Woman Day with Patty Jenkins, the director of the film, Gal Gadot, Linda Carter, and several of the bigwigs at DC Comics and Warner Brothers, which was really quite extraordinary. A work acquaintance wrote me, he goes, do you want to go to the United Nations tomorrow? And it's like, okay. And I thought he was in town, on vacation, and this was going to be some sort of tourist event, but it turned out it was something far more extraordinary. And then, of course, being thanked in both films and being able to go to the premiere of the first one has been really lovely. Wonder Woman's been a part of my life since I was 4 or 5 years old. So it's really this, I want to say, almost terrific full circle. And quite a gift, quite a lovely honor that I'm part of the official Wonder Woman record.
Mm. So you just mentioned... You were around 3 or 4 when you got your first Wonder Woman comic, I guess. So how did you get that comic? Was it a parent, a family member?
Well, my first exposure to Wonder Woman, I tell the story a lot because I think it's very funny, was actually on TV, and it was on the Brady Bunch spinoff, The Brady Kids, which was an animated show about the 6 Brady children. And they had episodes that guest starred Superman and Wonder Woman. And that's actually where I first was exposed to Wonder Woman. Mm. Was on a Brady Bunch spinoff. And then not long after, in her appearance on the Super Friends, but most importantly, the Linda Carter TV show. Mm. I often say I was actually not a comic book kid. I was a TV kid. Mm-hmm. And so my first real exposure to Wonder Woman, my love for her, came from the TV shows, and particularly Linda Carter's embodiment mm-hmm. of that character. Mm-hmm. I did have some Wonder Woman comics when I was a kid that my mother purchased for me, but I didn't become an avid comic book fan until the Star Wars movies came out. And then Marvel Comics put out a comic book to coincide with Star Wars and sort of ongoing adventures of the characters between the movies. And that's really what got me into comics, was not Wonder Woman, but Star Wars. Mm.
So being a fan of the 70s Wonder Woman show, did you spin around?
Oh, yeah. No. I still know how to do it. I used to do it at parties all the time. The spin was a big deal. I think Linda Carter even jokes at some point by the third season of that show, that's all it really was finding places for her to spin around and transform. But what we might have talked about this, I don't remember, but one of the things I really love about that spin and Wonder Woman and Supers particularly is the transformative aspect of it, right? Like you spin around, there's an explosion of light, and you suddenly go from being mundane and ordinary to being really extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite things about superheroes and the transformations they go through, because you sort of shed this outer skin and kind of like this sort of, the true hero comes out. And it sounds almost a little cliche, but I really believe in that there's something really powerful about transformation.
So you are an artist, you're a visual artist. You started drawing really young at like 3 or 4 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about how some high school friends that were twins made you realize that you could use your drawing ability to get into being a comics artist.
Oh my God, you've done your homework. That's amazing. Yes, so I'm going to name drop Eric and Erica Teasley. Were two friends of mine in junior high school. They were twins and they read comic books. And I was starting a new junior high school. They attended, they saw that I could draw. And one of them asked if I could draw some images, copy some images from some X-Men comics that they had. And it turned out I was pretty good at it. And that was actually my foray into the X-Men. I was obsessed with the X-Men and its spinoff, New Mutants, at the time. Like, nothing made me happier. There was nothing more important to me in my life at that time than those Marvel mutant characters. And then very soon after, I decided I was going to make my own superheroes, and I turned the Teasley twins and some other friends from high school into very, very cheap copies of those X-Men characters and started creating my own comics, which, as I understand it, is very common. So that's how I got going. And that's how I started drawing comics. And so I would spend most of my downtime in high school drawing comic book adventures of my friends, again, as sort of cheap copies of those X-Men characters. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I think I'd created almost 50 little handmade comics for my friends.
And do you still have those?
I have some of them. I just found them in a box. Many of them were, I can't believe, like, it's so funny, like, looking back, I would make a Xerox copies for friends and then hand color them, which is insane because I didn't charge any money for them. But I just found 3 or 4 of the originals, and it's mind-blowing to see that work and how much energy and time I put into it. And by the time I was a senior in high school, it was actually pretty good.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah, it was like, oh, look at that. I knew what I was doing.
You should share those with the world on your Instagram.
Oh, I will. I will. I have to. I've been organizing those boxes. I will definitely
or find for some a buck. You never know.
Yeah.
So for you, Phil Imanez, for you, drawing is a way or maybe an outlet for storytelling. Do you agree? Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, for sure. So I feel like all human beings generally, but I certainly was interested and compelled by storytelling. And particularly genre storytelling from the time I was a child. Fantastical worlds and beings were a real way for me to escape, which I think is very common for young LGBTQ kids. And I became really sort of entranced by the, fantastical nature of mostly epic stories, I would say. Everything from the Chronicles of Narnia to Lord of the Rings to even Wonder Woman and Star Wars. And so drawing was a way for me to tell my own stories. It was a way for me to channel imagination. It was a way for me to escape the world that I was living in. and enter other sort of fantastic realms. And I think what it did was hone my sense of story and storytelling. I have long said I don't think I'm the best drawer in the world, meaning anatomist or sort of structural drawer, but I do have a fairly good sense of design and a good sense of sort of emotional beat, which I think came from studying and just being consumed by stories of any kind when I was younger, even the ones you wouldn't think about. So I was a museum kid when I was younger, and I have been told that one of the reasons I'm so drawn to the stories in those, you know, dusty shelves and dinosaur bones and dioramas is the stories that are available even in there. So that's the other thing. I tend to see a storytelling opportunity in almost anything. So I'm just very, very interested in that. And I, one last note, I've often said that there are, a thing I tell my students all the time is that there are 7 billion people on the planet, and they each have stories far more interesting than mine. I just have the good fortune to have access to people that can let me tell my stories and a skill set that allows me to do that.
So let's break down a comic book, let's say. I'm sure most people know what comic books are. I'm sure everybody has like thumbed through them at some point. So when you're looking at those panels and the actions that are in those panels, how do you end up deciding what's in a panel? Talk to me about that. When it comes to the actions, how do you decide what's going to be in one of those panels?
Well, that's an amazing question. To start, generally, just for people that don't know, comic books are a highly collaborative medium, and there's usually one or two people on every part of the job. So there's a script writer, an artist, a colorist, someone who does the lettering, an editor who brings the whole job together. So while you do get your auteurs who do it all, often it's just we're just all parts of a larger machine, like a conveyor belt of construction. So when I get a script, assuming I'm not writing the book, my first job is to read it, get a sense of rhythm, physical action, emotional beats. And then when I'm breaking down a story, it's this combination of deciding what's the most important image to tell a particular moment. Because unlike a movie, comic books are still, they can't move. So it's almost like a collection of photographs, kind of assemblage into the story. So you need to choose the moments that will convey the story the most effectively, the most quickly in a single panel. And then you have to be very, very careful about what happens in the next panel, that there's enough information and enough corollary information that people can make the leap from one panel to another. They call this the magic of what happens in the gutter or in the between the panels, because the human brain fills in that part, of the storytelling. So a lot of it has to do with that. A lot of it has to do with design, how I design a page, determining on a page what is the most dynamic or important action that needs to be the physically biggest on the page and designing for that. Where the emotional beats are, because I design those differently than, say, I do an action beat, which will have a different sense of scale physically on the page. I'll draw certain things differently. So it's several things, but it's mostly considering story. It's considering design. It's knowing that there's a limit. There's about 20 pages, sometimes 25. So I have to tell all the story and say 100, 125 panels in this 25 pages. And I have to make sure that it makes sense to the reader, that sequentially no information is lost so that the reader can follow through, ideally, even if there were not words in the book.
So when you're looking at the script, in the script that you get beforehand, does it say this needs to be illustrated, or it's just basically dialogue and description and that's it? You decide what's going to be illustrated.
It depends. My favorite script writers tend to be minimal in their caption descriptions. often, I mean, the classic example that I give is, so Batman page would be like panel one, skyline of Gotham City, establishing shot, you know, the city at night, it's raining, the moon can be seen, you know, beaming through the clouds. So that's the information that I have. So it's up to me to decide what that's going to look like on a page, how that art is composed. Right. Panel two, close on, I'm going to say the Chrysler building or like, you know, a tall building, gargoyle, we see a small figure. Panel three, close on that figure. His, you know, the cape flows in the wind. It's Batman observing the city. So those are the sorts of descriptions. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to me to decide what those images actually look like.
Out of curiosity, do you remember your very first comic book that you got as a kid?
Yeah, it's actually Wonder Woman number 226.
Very specific.
It's very specific because I wrote a story that was an homage to it many, many years later. That was one of my more successful stories. But it was kind of brain exploding because Wonder Woman, the modern day Wonder Woman, met her 1940s counterpart in an adventure, and they fought this sort of Nazi dude. And I was blown away by the idea that there were two Wonder Womans in the story. And there's a whole, interestingly, I mean, I think a lot of people know now, but in DC Comics and Marvel Comics, there are alternate worlds and alternate realities and different versions of characters. And this was the my first exposure to that. So by the time I was six, I understood the idea of multiple of alternate universes and multiple timelines and things like that. So I was thinking a lot about that, you know, in third grade.
I'm interested to know, especially from you, the popularity of comic book movies, superhero movies, graphic novel movies, TV shows. What do you attribute the popularity to that particular genre? Because it's been going on for over a decade now. What do you attribute the popularity to that particular genre of movies and TV shows?
So I have a couple theories. I don't know if they're accurate, but these are mine. One is, again, I believe, I mean, there are a million different comic book movies. Ghost World was a comic book movie, for example. The Green Mile was based on a graphic novel. There are lots and lots of comic book movies out there that nobody would ever think were actually graphic novels or comics because there aren't superheroes in them. The superhero stuff, like the Marvel Comics universe, those X-Men characters, Spider-Man, I think two or three things, and it goes back to what I was talking about with Wonder Woman. One, they are larger than life characters. And for a lot of people, I think, who have sort of small mundane lives, they provide real fantasy and escape. They're incredibly visual movies. The best ones are just sort of epic in their scale and visualness and their scope. And I think that's very appealing. I think a lot of people like the idea of imagining themselves as heroes or seeing themselves do extraordinarily heroic things. I think there's an enormous power and purpose that comes from that kind of fantasy, like I'm going to save the world. The transformative powers of heroes, in the case of the X-Men, of course, there's that mutant metaphor. You know, which so many people see as a metaphor for queerness. And I think that's a really important part of that. It really helps that there's a lot of incredibly sexy people in very tight clothing. you know, I believe that's actually a real appeal of superheroes. You know, seeing Chris Hemsworth or Halle Berry doing, you know, their thing and in tight spandex is nice.
Appealing.
It's very, very appealing. But at the end of the day, I think superheroes specifically as a genre, I think part of their appeal is, it sounds a little banal, but it's a bit of that mythic quality, but it's fantasy projection. It's really just like Lord of the Rings or Narnia or any of those other heroic fantasies that allow for an enormous amount of escape and fantasy and a lot of what if. And I think also the case of the Marvel Universe, and then I will close, is that what they've done so successfully is essentially weave a soap opera through film. So something that we were used to in TV, which was the ongoing narrative, you know, of soap opera, like day or nighttime soap operas or even TV, they were able to do with film. So you couldn't just see one movie. You had to, it was all part of a larger tapestry. And I think people like to feel like they are part, when they're invested in something like that, they're investing in something large and complex and with intricacies. And I think they were very successful at playing into that.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast to coast.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station, specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
Hi there, I'm Bennett Singer, a documentary filmmaker and the co-director of the new film, Cured. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So for yourself, you came out, what, in 1992?
I was out and dating in 92. I think I came out of fish in my business in 94, and then publicly in publishing in 96.
And
I'm like one of the granddaddies of mainstream superhero comics.
Yeah. And so talk to me about that in terms of you coming out. Did you feel any responsibility? Do you just want to say it? Did you... Why did you feel like you needed to say, this is who I am?
So my coming out professionally had as much to do with my boyfriend who had passed away as it did anything else. So the first man I ever dated worked for DC Comics. His name is Neil Posner. And it's a kind of very common story in my backstory. It's sort of, forgive me if I'm going over old history, but he was a hugely, he had an enormous amount of personal impact on me, but he was an out gay man at DC Comics in the late 80s and early 90s, a designer, sort of really well respected in his business, and he passed away from AIDS in 94. And so my coming out publicly had as much to do with honoring him and his legacy as it did with any sort of declaration I felt the need to make. It was, at the time, it was less political statement. I mean, clearly it's always political, but it was less deliberate, meaning like I'm going to come out and say something to the world, as it was making sure people did not erase this Neil or erase his past. It was so much more about honoring him. And then when I found out what a big deal it was, I took that responsibility very seriously, and I still do. I'm happy that in, 25 years later, there's so many more openly out gay creators in mainstream superhero comics. I did not realize at the time, because I knew many gay artists, but that none were professionally out. And there was a period of time in Marvel Comics, hilariously enough, in the 80s, where there was a real sort of anti-gay tenor to their line, and that sort of trickled down from the editor-in-chief. It's so funny now, because they think of them as such a sort of progressive company when it comes to characters and representation. But there was a time when it was not welcome. And so, I babble on, I'm simply saying that I don't think I realized at the time how historic it was. Once I did, I took it very seriously. I still take it very seriously. I'm very grateful for my little moment in history. I hope I made an impact. My sense is that I did. And I continue to believe very, very strongly in being out in whatever capacity we can be, socially, politically, and otherwise, in our workplaces.
You were just mentioning about making an impact. I think you have, obviously you have made an impact, because
yes.
GLAAD, you were nominated for a GLAAD Award for your gay positive comics work. Talk to me about
a long time ago. To be fair, that was actually, I did not create that character. So I worked on the first, there's a book that was created by author Grant Morrison, who's just truly brilliant, and he created a team called the Invisibles, and they were a group of underground anarchists out trying to destroy the forces that control our lives. And one of the teams, the Cells, had a drag queen shaman from Brazil named Lord Fanny, and she was fabulous. And in the 90s, I was working on this character, and I have to say, I'm the quick circle. One of the assignments I had when I took this job was that the Invisibles had started floundering, and part of it was this feeling it might have been a little too underground, a little too British. And so they wanted me to Americanize it a little bit. And I took Lord Fanny, and I sort of took away her edge and made her a little bit more like RuPaul visually, which was quite successful. But in hindsight, I wish I knew more at the time about underground drag, because I think it probably would have been a stronger representation of what the author wanted, and ultimately far more, edgy and progressive. It was a safe version of her. That said, it was also historic, and I'm pretty happy and proud of it. And now whenever I get the chance to draw her, I bring some of her original edge back into her drag. So I got nominated for a GLAAD Award too, like early on. And what's been really, really amazing is how now, like, it's just a category. So many graphic novels, so many comics. There's so much representation in comics, even though it might not seem like it, that they're nominated every year for GLAAD Awards.
Really?
Yeah. GLAAD Awards, I think, almost every year have some sort of graphic novel category.
Wow. I didn't know that. So speaking of representation, I believe it's 2019, the show Batwoman became the first network TV show to have an LGBT superhero front and center.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
My
And I believe it's on the CW.
It was. And the character has since been recast. I believe it's a whole new version of her. Because the actress, Rose, I can't think of her last name, left? Who may have been gender non-binary. I forget how they classified themselves. But it was sort of wonderful. I do feel like the interesting thing about the CW shows specifically, those, is that they're targeted to younger viewers. There are so many of them. Greg Berlanti, an out gay creator, is the showrunner for all of them. There are a lot of gay people that work on them. And it also just seems to me, and this is gross and cynical, but at some point, they're always going to be looking for new angles. So a gay female, like a lesbian back character, pardon me, that's an angle they can play in a show. Sort of Black Lightning, I was very excited when they brought that character to life, and he and his family, it became a sort of a show that was charged with racial issues, which is sort of what they should be. One thing I'm always really interested in when it comes to representation is how much what they're representing becomes a part of their story. So if you have a gay character, particularly a gay lead, how much of that world is about their gay life, right? And there's, I think, a really interesting conflict, I would say, between creators and fans about how much or how little of that they're interested in.
Right. Their sexual lives.
Or the example that I give is, I have a lot of gay friends, right, that I'm not having sex with, right? Mm-hmm. But it's, we often will gravitate to like people mm-hmm. in a similar group to hang out, to socialize, because we have shared language, vocabulary, mm-hmm. experience, et cetera. So when you island an othered character, like the gay character, she has no gay friends, or they're not out in the town having a gay night on the town, you know, or whatever, it seems weird to me. Not that that has to be the crux of the show, but I'm always looking to see how much of their life is expansive. Like, I've often said that my gay life is as much political and social as it is sexual, although it's all intertwined. I can't really strip one from the other, but, like, I have my friends and a social network and even a career that is rooted in my gayness and being out and my expressions and my gender and sexuality, right? So it's, I don't find them so easy to unbuckle or untwine, as it were. And it's the same with characters who are being marketed as the first, right? It's the first, black superhero on TV, right? And then the interesting, I think, political question becomes how much of their racial, ethnic, or regional identity becomes a part of that character.
Right.
And if it doesn't, what does that mean or say? That's always an interesting question for me.
Are you ever tapped to give your opinions, your advice on some shows like that?
No, I've been...
Because you're obviously connected.
Comic people are there to provide the base material, and then it's sort of taken away from us to be turned into movies and TV. Mm. That's not always true. There's some crossover. And in the early days of development on Wonder Woman, I was consulted a few times. Mm. But generally, that's a fairly partitioned world. But I think it's changing. I think it also has to do with if you own the material or if, say, Disney and Warner Brothers owns the material. So my friend Derek Robertson, who was the artist in The Boys, I know was, a fairly active...
A great person. Show.
It's an amazing show.
Mm-hmm. On Amazon.
On Amazon. I believe he was there. He was on set. I think he had more of a say, or at least, you know, could come in and chime in, because it was his show, it was his property. It wasn't a Warner Brothers property. It wasn't a Disney property. I think if you're working for a mainstream superhero company, we have less say in what happens with the films and TV. Mm. But I think that's also changing.
It was nice to see in, I think it's season two, Maven, in the one of the characters, like the Wonder Woman character in The Boys. Her love life, we saw more. And the complications of that.
Yes. And the interesting, and I have arguments with fans about this, the interesting complications that arise not simply from issues of gender and sex, but when you're... when your coworker is a crazy superpowered Nazi, like you're like, oh, what do you do about that? I was having some heated discussions with some fans about the interesting wrinkle of metaphor in superhero shows and comics, because you're not just always talking about like two gay people clashing or their love life. You're also talking about people that can explode brains with their minds, or, you know, manipulate metal with a thought, or can throw a car over their heads. And so it makes the, sometimes it's a really interesting complication about how much or how little to deal with issues of sex and gender when they're also trying to stop the world from being, you know, destroyed by space aliens.
Yeah. Or have yourself be killed by your coworker.
Right, exactly. Or you're like, oh my gosh, like, you know, he can hear us from a thousand miles away.
Yeah. What did you think of Wonder Woman 1984?
I thought it was an attempt to be, I think it was an homage to like the 70s and 80s films. I think Patty Jenkins.
Richard Donner.
Yeah, I really said it was like a Richard Donner's homage. Mm-hmm. I think she was as successful as possible. The thing that I think is really amazing about Wonder Woman is the casting of that Gal Gadot, because she just remains so likable in that role that you're constantly rooting for her. And actually, I guess that's Zack Snyder that really discovered her. But the strength of those movies and whatever sort of weaknesses they have, I'm amazed at how much they're held together by Gal. Like, it's really, they really scored with a Wonder Woman for this time period. And it's really extraordinary to see. I will say, like so many in both the first and second movie, I think the Amazons were so interesting. And I think we need to see a lot more of them.
The first movie made me cry. I'll say that. Yeah, the first one in the, I think the No Man Land scene.
Yes.
Powerful stuff. I want to ask your opinion. Do you think that coming from Themyscira, and I am not a comic book
doesn't matter
history person or anything like that, but do you think that the Amazonians, like Wonder Woman, do you think that she would be bisexual or pansexual or anything like that? What are your thoughts on that?
So it was established back in the 80s, actually, that the Amazons ran the gamut. So some of them were lesbians, some of them were chaste, some married each other, others were celibate, right? Like the thing that, and that's pretty much carried through for the past 25 years, whenever they deal with sex and sexuality on the island, there's this whole, I mean, it's usually in the back, it's not really front and center, but there's this whole range of possibilities. The one thing I will say, and this gets very in the weeds, so take it or leave it, but there's a lot of fan fiction, there's even stuff in the comics about relationships Diana might have had growing up. And the weird thing about that for me is just practical. One, she's the daughter of a queen. She's the princess. So I'm like, who's good enough for the princess on that island, right? Like, I can almost imagine, like, the queen, her mother, who's so overprotective, like, looking through the crowd being like, nope, 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 not you, not you, not you, right? Like, nobody's good enough for my daughter, right? Like, I can almost imagine that. And then the second thing, of course, is just that she was the only child on that island. And so it makes me wonder about the dynamics when you have an island full of mothers and aunts raising you, and then suddenly you're an adult. Mm-hmm. I mean, this gets very practical. Do they see you as a sort of
a sexual being?
As a sexual being.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's how I've always thought about it. But at least in the comic books, from like the late 80s on, in these intervals, you will see relationships of all kinds. I actually, I did an Amazon Civil War during my run on Wonder Woman, and it was about two warring tribes of Amazons, and it was sort of like a Romeo and Juliet. I don't know what the female equivalent of that is, but they were like from two warring tribes, and they were the sort of love center, and that was like the whole point of the story, and one ends up betraying the other for her people, and you know, not an eyelash was bad, like no one batted an eyelash. It's not even a thing. I think a lot of people now, certainly in 2021, just assume that there are many, many people having relationships on the island. And finally, if you look back at the original 1940s material, it is clear those Amazons were not only sexual, but they were into a lot of different fetish. They were into some things.
Do you think that angle to Wonder Woman in 2021, 22 going forward, do you think that might be hinted to or brought to the fore at all in the movies?
The fetish?
Not the fetish, but her potential bisexuality, pansexuality, that sort of thing?
That's a great question. I think it would be easier on TV than in film for a very simple, practical reason. Those films, at least now, this might change all tomorrow, have to sell to China. And China is a huge global market, and they are very skittish about same-sex relationships on screen in any sort of overt way. So I don't know. I am skeptical, but I'm a never-say-never person. I think it's all about timing and content, et cetera. Like, I think it will be hard, but not because I think of global economics of filmmaking, not right. Because of interest from creators.
Right. I mean, so much could be told by just a look or the touch of a hand.
100%. 100%.
Without going any further, it's like, you know, oh my God, what did that look mean?
Right. And it's interesting because people always debate that too, right? Like, is that enough? Is that playing too coy if it's not explicit? Yeah. I've been in some very interesting conversations with people about explicit displays of homosexual sex and homosexual love, or same-sex relationships. And I come from I'm just going to say it's almost generational, like where maybe because I never expected it, I never demanded it. It never occurred to me that it was important. And that I was much more interested in the overall queerness of something than I was in the specificity of same gender relationships on screen. So like one of the reasons I liked Wonder Woman was because the world itself was just so queer and so colorful and so vibrant and striking. And same with the X-Men, like those worlds were so progressive that I didn't need specific examples of representation, but I feel like, again, that's generational. A lot of younger people I speak to really need and seem to demand physical representation in material. And so my hope is that it is provided to them.
Before I let you go, Entertainment Weekly, The Advocate, Out Magazine, all consider you one of the most prominent gay creators in mainstream comics. Thoughts?
My thoughts is...
Hell yeah!
That's old. I think there was a time when that was actually true. I think there are a lot of other really prominent voices now, which makes me happy, particularly women and non-gender binary folk. So that just thrills me. I was looking at I put in the Out 100 a couple times and in the Advocate, and the thing that's really fun and funny about that is it's like a lovely little moment in history. Mm. Like, I'm always really grateful for that acknowledgement. And like, how cool is that to have a biography?
I know, like, that's fantastic.
That's the Out 100. It's not something I think about that often, but it's a very, very nice honor to have, to be sure.
So what's coming up next for you? What are you working on?
So the big thing that I have been working on, which is about a year late, and I think will be out this year finally, is called Historia. It is a Wonder Woman graphic novel. It's actually about the history of the Amazons, written by Kelly Sue DeConnick, who is an incredible author, best known for books like Bitch Planet and Pretty Deadly and Captain Marvel at Marvel Comics. And what I really love about it is the first time a woman has ever written the history of the Amazons in comics. While there have been other female creators who have taken on Wonder Woman's origin, this is the first that takes on the origin of the Amazons themselves. And so it's a huge honor. It has been, it's the best work of my career. It has taken way too long, but again, I think it'll be out in the fall. And then after that, I have, there's a couple, two projects I'm praying go through, because there's sort of culmination of everything I'm interested in with, you know, gender, ethnic identity, superheroes, all that kind of stuff. But the big thing will be wrapping up Historia and getting out for fans, because they've been waiting a really, really long time, and so has DC Comics.
Fantastic. Feli Manas, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being on the
show.
Thank
you. It was lovely.
That was my 2021 interview with award-winning comic artist and writer, Feli Manas. Since that interview originally aired, in 2023, Wonder Woman Historia, The Amazons, was released and quickly became one of New York Public Library's top 10 best new comics for adults. Plus, on August 13th, 2024, Spider-Man Brand New Day Omnibus Volume 1 was released, of course, with artwork by Feli Manas. By the way, on Amazon.ca, both Wonder Woman Historia, The Amazons, and Spider-Man Brand New Day Omnibus Volume 1 have a rating of 4.8 out of 5 stars. Taking us to Hour 2 of Rainbow Country, originally released in 1979, Insect Love, Martha and the Muffins.
I'm Simone Denny, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is Hour 2 of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house, So if you stay with me, if you stick with me, I hope you think I'm bringing you music worth hearing. Starting us off, a classic house set.